official home of the Canucks.
Dinky Pete comes out of the box and puts the puck into the back of the net.
Sportsnet 650.
Welcome back to Vic and the Boss here on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. It is a game day versus the Oilers. They have a chance to clinch their playoff spot tonight. Obviously, they're well on their way to going to it, but you want to get that X next to your name. It always makes the standings look a little bit nicer for you when you get that X next to your name and you've clinched it. So they need 1 point tonight to clinch that. Hopefully, the Canucks can make that as difficult as possible. But what's the goal for these next four games here, C-Mac? Is it just make sure McDavid doesn't get to 100 versus you? Because every Canucks fan knows, like, every milestone goal or point goes against the Canucks, yeah. Right? It's Gretzky's 802. There's a litany of them. It's always, oh, here we go. It's against us again. Every Canucks fan feels that way. But is that all it is? Is just hold off and make sure he doesn't score versus you?
No, it's get a split. You know, you're right. Think of those Oilers teams of the 80s and being a Canucks fan growing up and living here and watching, you know, Messier, Gretzky, Curry, Coffey. They just rolled in here and, you know, rolled in and got eight goals a game and put stupid numbers on the board. And you're right. Every time Gretzky seemed to be breaking a record, it was against Kirk McLean. And I feel bad for Mac because he's a great goalie, but those Oiler powerhouse teams and the Canucks, yeah, not so much. And while I wouldn't say if this was a fair fight and the Canucks were healthy and maybe not having gone through the COVID thing, they're a lot closer to the Oilers now than they were back then in the 80s. But yeah, holding McDavid and Draisaitl down, you know, will be a challenge. But one, I'm sure you're right, they don't want McDavid to get his 13 points or whatever, some ridiculous to get to 100 in this shortened season. It just shows you the type of year that he's having and how good a hockey player he is. And it's funny, you know, you asked Bick about watching all those guys. I saw McDavid for the very first time in Penticton at the rookie training camp. And, you know, I've seen a lot of fast players and guys who can skate and, you know, Pavel Bure being one of them and all that. But I don't know that I've ever seen a guy like McDavid, just how quick he was and what he could do with the puck at full speed. I mean, that's the difference. There's a lot of people who can skate fast up and down the ice and come to a stop at the red line if you were skating in a straight line. But to do things with the puck on your stick and dance around players, he's special. So it's going to be really difficult for the Canucks to slow him down tonight and over the next four games. And maybe that's a goal that they have. But I do know, you know, these guys are competitors. They want to win as many hockey games now between here and the end of the season. And they've got to get a victory here sooner than later because, you know, it just gets so daunting, the schedule, and the task gets even tougher. So if the Oilers can clinch a playoff spot, maybe they rest a few guys and the Canucks can pick up a few victories.
650-650, if you want to get your thoughts in. We had some late don't at me's as well. I had one about the Leafs here, but I've since just lost it here in a second.
There was a don't at me by Shiloh, who basically, I'm paraphrasing, said that I should give a percent of my salary to you for a raise because the only reason I have a job is because of you. So that was a shouts to him. But a percentage of what I'm making, nothing is nothing. So you're not getting a big bump, buddy, but you might get a bit of some cents, let's say, not even dollars. We'll give you some cents for that.
That works out for me. We were heading to break, and we were just talking about the Travis Green situation, obviously, still without a contract. One of the other elements in this situation, too, is how much are owners and management keeping an eye on what the coaching market looks like? And one of the biggest names on the potential free agent coaching market is going to be Rod Brind'Amour, and who's obviously having a lot of success in Carolina. And I'm curious if this is developing kind of like how it goes in the free agent market, where the elite guys get paid and everyone kind of filters in behind them. And is everyone kind of waiting for the first domino to fall? And this is what Elliot Friedman kind of reported over on the weekend on headlines, which you saw on Hockey Night, but also in today's 31 Thoughts. It's talking about Rod Brind'Amour quite a bit. And here's what Elliot had to share his thoughts on the Brind'Amour situation as it stands now.
And now there are people saying that they're wondering if it's going to happen. And I do think that there are teams out there looking at this and saying, if we have the opportunity, we'll back up the Brinks truck for Brind'Amour and give him more money than in Carolina, because the belief is if he stays there, he's going to take less than he can get on the market because he wants to be there. But the issue is his staff, and I'm not just talking about his coaching staff, the assistant coaches, the goaltending coach, but also the training and the equipment staff, they don't have contracts for next year. And apparently what Brind'Amour has said is, I want these people taken care of, and I won't sign until I know that they're taken care of. And, you know, I don't know where this is going to go. I think there is a chance he still stays, obviously. Like I said, I believe he wants to stay. But I think right now he's taking a stand for the rest of his staff because he feels that they should be taken care of too. And if you know anything about Brind'Amour, I don't think this would come as a huge surprise.
That's Elliot Friedman when he was talking on 31 Thoughts, a podcast, which is available now on your local podcatchers, whichever one you use. And it's interesting there of what's kind of holding up one deal, potentially, in Carolina with Rod Brind'Amour. And, you know, the thing I'm kind of looking at is, because he might be the marquee name available for free agent head coaches this summer, does one getting done help out the rest of the scenarios across the league, whether it be Rick Tocchet, whether it be Travis Green, whatever it is, or the Seattle Kraken? Is this kind of the final thing that needs to happen? Rod Brind'Amour's assistant coach is getting handled out to filter in the rest of the moves that we want to see across the league.
I'm not so sure, Bick, because in Brind'Amour's case, and hey, think of it, a BC boy, if the Canucks could, you know, go out and get him and bring him in. But in this case, and for those who know Brind'Amour and how much he likes it in that area, his family's comfortable, he really doesn't want to go anywhere, isn't, you know, trying to be mercenary in this. He wants to stay in that spot, but my thought is, in listening to what Elliot had to say there, in order for him to take a bit less or not as much as he can command on the open market, he wants to take care of his boys. And that just speaks to what a leader and what a great person Brind'Amour is. So he wants his not only his coaches, but his trainers and all the staff taken care of before it gets to him. And that is why I think he's just trying to take care of everyone and take a lesser amount than what he could get on the open market, because he really doesn't want to go anywhere. Travis Green, I don't think, wants to go anywhere either. He likes it here. He likes the job, but is probably more willing or wanting to test the open market if things don't go well here in Vancouver. So to answer your point, I don't think this is holding up anything. This is a separate deal, separate issue. This is Brind'Amour trying to do the right thing for all the people who have worked with him. And, you know, hey, they clinched a playoff spot for the third consecutive year since Brind'Amour was named coach. He's done a fantastic job. And you see how that team is bought in and all the crazy antics they did. And there's a real sense of community there. And I think it starts with Rod Brind'Amour.
They did detail on that as well. Not exact figures, but essentially, right, Elliot Friedman was suggesting that it's below, I guess, his value of what you would expect if you were available. There would be teams lining up to pay a significant chunk of money. And, you know, what we've heard from time and time again is there's a want and desire from owners across the league to try to rein in spending on coaching. Because there's some coaches that have gotten big contracts. Your Quenvilles of the world. You know, Mike Babcock, when he was with Toronto, obviously started the push to get coaches a lot more money. And then you throw in like what Ralph Kruger was making. And I'm sure a lot of other coaches are looking at that and thinking, hey, that's a mark that I should be getting. And if a guy who's going to be very sought after wants to stay in his position in Carolina and does so at below value, does that depress the rest of the situations across the league? Again, it's very interesting to see how it plays out, but to me that is one thing that once it comes to a conclusion, maybe it kickstarts the rest of the stuff across the league. Of course, here in Vancouver with Travis Green as well, because, hey, 11 games remaining, it could be the final 11 games Travis Green coaches in Vancouver. Bick Nizar and Craig McEwen here on Bick and the Boss on a game day. You always like to hear from Travis Green. So here is Travis Green's media availability after today's morning skate.
Travis, with Sutter confirmed to be out of the lineup, you're down six regular NHL forwards from your lineup, plus, you know, Justin Bailey. What sort of challenges does that pose for you, especially considering, you know, the upcoming 3 and 4 here?
Yeah, it's when you look at it like that, and you've got seven with Michaelis, he's got an upper body injury as well. So that's eight guys that are possible to play. You know, it's a lot. You don't usually run into that. I don't think we have before. We've had eight forwards hurt. So it's good opportunity for other players. B, you're going to have a team that's got to play well. And we've been talking to our group about skating and energy in our game. I think we need that in our game, but also confidence with the puck to make plays. We haven't scored many goals here as of late. Obviously, we've got some guys out of the lineup that contribute to that, but you've got to have confidence to make the right play and the smart play and also execute the plays that you need to at the NHL level. So if we've got that energy and we got confidence, obviously we got a team that wants to compete hard. We need to bring those elements if we want to win tonight against a good team.
And Travis, bear with me a bit. This one requires a little setup, but as I reflected on your game against Toronto on Saturday over the weekend, it seemed to me like they weren't necessarily going in the first 40 minutes, even as your team deserves some credit for your play as well. But Austin Matthews obviously was incredible. It sort of got me thinking about the absence of, in particular, number 40.
Right.
And what impact that's had. What can you tell us from your perspective about how much that absence has hurt your club's offense and all-around game?
Well, I mean, where do you start? When you don't have your top players, a good example was the other night where maybe Toronto isn't on top of their game, and I thought we played a very strong two periods and a game-breaker gets two goals, but you miss that. It's not an excuse, but I'm not also not going to sit here and say we don't miss that in our lineup. Now we've won before without him. But we also had some other players playing, and Petey's a big part of our team. He's a big part of our future. He's trying to get back. He's working hard to get back, and obviously he's not. If he was ready to play, he would. But when you talk about your top end players and what they bring to your group, there's a reason why those guys are where they're at. They're difference makers. They create chances. They alleviate pressure easily, not just in the offensive zone, but in your own zone. But we can't dwell on it. And we haven't been. He's a big part, but he's not here. And we worry about the guys that are here.
Next up, we'll go to Ben Kuzma.
Morning, Travis.
Hey, Coos.
A couple from me. You referenced all your injuries up front, and even when you guys have been healthy, Travis, you've had your moments against McDavid and Draisaitl, certainly in the first game and the fifth meeting where you've minimized the damage. Coaches always talk about trying to keep McDavid to maybe one side of the ice. We know how versatile he is and how he can weave east and west. What is the challenge just to try to minimize the damage against him and Draisaitl, who are 1-2 in scoring?
What's the question? What's the
challenge? How can you minimize the damage against these guys? I mean, you've had a couple of outings where you've kept them to basically a point.
Yeah.
They've exploded in other games.
Well, they explode every once in a while against a lot of teams, Coos. I think we, there's every team in the league has a game plan going into it. These guys face the toughest defenders in the league every night. They're the focal point of every team they play. They're the reason why they're two of the best players in the world. And you usually just don't shut players like that down. There are certain parts of your game, your systems, that maybe you've got to tweak a little bit when you play them. You've definitely got to be aware when they're on the ice. But they're great players, and they create a lot of chances. And we have had some nights where we've been able to do a pretty good job and five on five anyway. But you know, when you look at the scoring leaders and you see what they're capable of, there's a lot of nights they don't stop them. And if we want to win tonight, we're going to have to. That's obviously part of the game plan when you play Edmonton. It's no secret.
Colin made his regular season debut last week and looked like he's obviously got some game. Is there a plan, Travis, for Jack Rathbone? I know it's the most difficult position to acclimate to at this level, but you've got all these games, 11 games crammed into 17 days, virtually no practice time outside of game day. Do you have a plan for Jack Rathbone? Or are we going to see him at some point?
We have a plan for all our players, Kuz. Is there a chance you'll see Jack Rathbone? There's certainly a chance. I'm not going to sit here and tell you when and what night and what game, but we're considering everything. And I think Cole Lynn's gone in and done a good job. And there's a chance you'll see other young players go in as well.
Okay, we have time for one more with Coach Green. We'll go to Lachlan Irvin with the Botchford Project.
Hey, Travis. Nils Höglander's had a pretty unorthodox rookie season. I mean, going from playing 20 games in the Swedish Hockey League to and now ending up playing with Miller and Besser on the first line. How do you feel that he's handled the adversity and the on-ice work this season in compared to the previous rookies and rookie years you've had on the team?
Well, he's a different player than the other guys that we've had, in lots of ways. Each guy's different. Every rookie that comes in the league, I think he's shown some good glimpses of what he can be. He's had some great games. At times, the season's looked a little long for him. He's learning a lot on the fly as well, a lot of little details in the game with the smaller ice. Time and space is different. Offensively, I think it's been a bonus for him. On the flip side, though, defensively sometimes and his play with the puck in the neutral zone, he's still getting used to that part. But he's definitely a bright player for us. Excited to see how he develops from year to year. He's only going to get better.
That's Travis Green meeting with media earlier today. And, you know, some interesting thoughts there, especially kind of off the top where he's talking about Elias Pettersson. Just it is a component that's, you know, when you see what happened on Saturday, the contrast between, hey, what Matthews can do just in a flash and turn a game on its head versus what's an element that the Canucks are sorely missing right now. It's just that game-breaker mentality of you give half a chance to someone and they can bury it, or at least, you know, start flipping the pressure around and try to build sustained momentum for your team. That element is really missing right now. And as hard as they can work and they are working, the effort is there. It's just that extra little bit is not. And you're asking a lot of your Travis Boyd and Jimmy VCs to try to flip a game on its head.
Yeah, those guys haven't been able to do it throughout their career, and we can't expect them to do it now. The thing that's impressed me, Bic, I mean, this isn't a knock on Pettersson because, you know, he is a game changer, a game breaker, but, you know, they had such a bad start to the year, the Canucks, with him in the lineup, and then, you know, he gets hurt, and I'm thinking, oh, this could go really from bad to worse, and the Canucks found a way to get results without him. But to your point, those were hardworking, tight-checking, low-scoring games, right? You don't have that guy who's going to pot a couple goals like a Matthews did right now. I mean, yes, Besser's a good shooter, and Miller can score a bit, and Horvat's proved that. And hey, even the Tanner Pearson has chipped in with about four goals in his last eight games. But without Pettersson in the lineup, you can't run and gun or take on these teams, and it has to be so tight and so defensive, and your goalie has to stand on his head, and the margin of error is so slim that's where now they're starting to run into problems when you see these teams putting 3, 4, 5 goals up on them. They just can't compete without Pettersson in the lineup. They might be able to do it for a game, hey, maybe two of the last to get in a shootout, but they're not built that way right at this moment to kind of chase leads and to overcome big deficits.
And there's kind of a tax to playing that way of the players that you mentioned, right? Your Horvat, Pearson, those types of players. Yeah, they can score goals, right? And they're very productive. I get that. But think of like the location of where they score goals. Borovat is not really a long-range shooter. Tanner Pearson, very much not a long-range shooter. Yeah, he can get the auto one off the half wall when it bounces off David Riddick's pad when it's clearly not going in. But, you know, they're not your prototypical snipers where the puck's on the stick, it's off, and it's in the back of the net. That's not their game, and so they have to get to do hard areas. And that is taxing to try to generate your offense from the most difficult area of the ice when you've got a bunch of guys on your roster that have to do it that way. You mentioned Besser. Like, right now, it's probably only Besser and Miller who can kind of create their own shot. Everyone's kind of has to do it with help, either winning battles along the boards, your teammates got to do it, and then the puck can come to you in the middle. Outside of those two guys, and if you throw Elias Pettersson in there, those are really the only three players that can create their own shot, to take a basketball analogy here, to create something that is they can individually score their goal. I think we may have lost C-Mac there. We'll get him back before the end of the break, as we're going to be talking about the NFL draft as well. Your thoughts as well, 650, 650. We'll speak to Emory Hunt in just a minute, now that we're through the draft weekend. First round on Thursday was fantastic. Shout out to the San Francisco 49ers. But how did your Raiders fare, C-Mac, and how did my Seahawks fare as well? They only had three picks. How did they manage to secure value in that spot? I'll share my thoughts as well on the Seahawks, and Emory Hunt will join us in just a minute here on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Bic and the Boss. Bic Nizar, Craig McEwen here on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. It is a Canucks game day, 7 o'clock puck drop. Corey Hirsch, Brendan Batchelor with the call. Pregame show at 5 o'clock, the Land Rover pregame show. Sat, Dan, Randeep got you covered at 5 o'clock leading into puck drop. We were talking about stylistically, you know, how they can get goals and getting to those dirty areas, and they don't have enough game breakers on the roster right now, obviously, because you know, a player like Elias Pettersson out, and some depth issues as well. This text coming in, unsigned text, that's on coaching too. Canucks have no clear way on how to score. That's the system. I think that's, you know, just a fair point to make in all of this, just the manner in which they try to generate chances. I would also say that also kind of goes to the players that have been provided too, right? You try to place guys in their best positions to succeed, and they have a lot of net front presence type players, and their stated goal has been to get shots from the point, get pucks to the difficult areas, and then capitalize on rebounds, tip-ins, deflections, whatever you can do to try to generate offense that way. And that's why you see a lot of point shots from the Vancouver Canucks. That's why, you know, their defense have scored some points here, because it's putting the puck into that dangerous area and then trying to convert. It's not necessarily the most attractive style of hockey, but there is a insistence on trying to do that, and that's why you see signings like Tanner Pearson, Michael Ferland. That's the spirit of behind some of those deals, is this is the way they want to play hockey. And to me, it can work, obviously, and you see in the playoffs, dirty goals go in, right? It's how teams have success. But you still need that element of, hey, how do we get superstar players to win their individual battles by themselves? And there probably isn't enough of that as well in this team.
Yeah, and that playing that kind of that aggressive bang in the rebound takes energy. Mm-hmm. And right now the Canucks don't have a ton of it. And when it's successful, you can get guys to buy in. Like, you know, in Ottawa, they bought in playing that way, and they work hard and they fight for every inch and they try to get to those loose pucks in battle. And when you get victories and you're rewarded for it, it's great. When it's not working and it's just tough and it's hard and you've been through a COVID scare and you don't have that, you know, extra little bit of juice in the tank, that's when it becomes very difficult, because you're selling the players on a vision or a plan that isn't producing results. So they're going to be like, I got to work harder to get this done. Man, oh man, I don't know how much I have left to give here. It's been such a tough year.
Good text coming into that 650, 650 text message inbox. Keep sharing your thoughts as well on anything that is on your mind. So the NFL draft wrapped up over the weekend. Still not perfect, though, the way we want to pull off the draft. You know, it being all separate locations and you want to have more prospects there at the draft, but it was still a good showcase to pull it off, and it was reinforced quite a bit that everyone there was fully vaccinated and whatnot at the draft. So that was a fascinating piece to watch. But it's over, and everyone starts plotting out who is the big winners and whatnot. And locally, the Seattle Seahawks only had 3 picks, which is tough to do in an NFL draft, but through their 3 picks, I thought they did about as well as they could. I really like the players. Maybe some of them were a bit reaches, but I thought they did about as well as they could having only 3 draft picks. And they attacked some needs that are very obvious and glaring. Going to go get a receiver in Dwayne Eskridge, getting an offensive lineman in Stone Forsythe, and needing a defensive back with Trey Brown. They really attacked what their needs were in the NFL draft. We'll get into the details on those players with our guy, Emory Hunt, from Football Game Plan, the SAR of the playbook, and you can hear him on CBS Sports and CBS Sports HQ. Emory, how was your Christmas with the NFL draft over the weekend?
It was good, man. I'm just, glad that it's over. at the end of the day, it's a grind, and, you study your players, you watch the film, and it's good to finally see it play out. Now you know where these guys are going to go, and just kind of evaluate from there and just start the process for 2022.
We were just talking about what the Seattle Seahawks did over the weekend. Obviously, only 3 picks, and you can only do so much when you've got such little draft capital. Watching these guys in the pre-draft process, one of my favorites, but, he's a bit older, obviously, was Dwayne Eskridge. Just your thoughts on him just as a prospect and what the film says to you.
Well, I've seen him up close and personal. I did a broadcast when they played Monmouth, and he was playing cornerback at the time. But you saw the explosiveness, you saw the elusiveness, the acceleration was there. He was a guy that was also returning kicks and punts. And so this year, watching him at receiver, you're just like, wow, this dude is a legit stud. I think at one point in time during the season, he was averaging like 21.5 yards a catch. That's just ridiculous. And so it shows you that this dude is a game breaker and also a playmaker with the ball in his hand. So you envision him running those deep over routes while Tyler Lockett is running deep over routes on the other side. It's just like that's just a lot of speed to chase around if you're a defensive back.
Does he fit well with what Russell Wilson would want to do? Obviously, Seahawks have a new offensive coordinator, and there's going to be some stuff. But letting Russ cook, is this the type of player that can add to that and some spice? And you mentioned with the dual threat of Lockett, how impactful could he be with a guy like Russell Wilson under center?
Very, because you envision how they utilize Tyler Lockett and what Lockett means for someone like Russell Wilson. He's more of the deep threat. Eskridge could be that strong intermediate threat that can catch that short to intermediate pass over the middle of the field or such a quick slant or something like that and just take it to the house. So this dude is just – he's going to be a day one stud. He's going to be a core special teamer and one that's going to be impactful with the ball in his hands. And again, while Lockett is running deep, you could utilize Eskridge, the wide receiver run game, end arounds, those little pop passes. You just want him – with the ball in his hands in space and allow him to do his thing.
So because he's much older, right? It's his birthday was at the end of March. He's 24 years old as he enters into the NFL. Does that mean he's more quote unquote pro ready, or is this just a guy who valued going through the whole college process?
Yeah, I guess you could say he's more pro ready. He's played a lot. He has been injured. So that kind of factors in. But for someone like him, it's just like, if you're fast, as long as you're fast like he is and dangerous with the ball in his hands and can help you out initially on special teams, if you can do one thing very well consistently, you already are pro ready. So, that's where, the expectations for a lot of these guys have to start, especially the guys that are taken outside of rounds 1 and 2. Okay, how can it affect special teams? And this is a guy that can, right off the bat, be your gunner, be your returner, help you cover kicks on kickoff. That's someone that you want. And the fact that he has experience as a corner shows you that he's not afraid to tackle. And so just that being a foundation allows him to then grow into the role as a receiver. So I just think that they couldn't pass up on someone with that level of talent and explosiveness because he can help you impact special teams.
Listen, my guilty pleasure will be that I'm going to turn this to the Raiders now because it's the team that I've supported as a kid growing up, and I've threatened to dump them a few times. You know, when they moved to LA, I was happy they went back to Oakland. Now they're in Vegas. But my guilty pleasure would be the Raiders. And once again, the Raiders being the Raiders, you know, make a pick in the first round and Alex Leatherwood, which by Mayock's own words was controversial. And so I guess what the Raiders did in addressing, they needed some help on the O-line, and then they need some help in the secondary to take a safety number two, which I like to pick, but then to take two other safeties, can you figure out what the Raiders are doing in Vegas, or am I way off in not seeing something here? And it just seems every year they go off the board and do something that's a little bit different.
You know, I think when we talk about the draft, we have to look at it in terms of we on this side of the fence as the media only see it from a player evaluation perspective. Those on the other side in the evaluation side of things, or the personnel side of things, I'm sorry, they see it more as, okay, they have more intel. So, you know, they may know why they're going with certain people. You look at, let's say, Abram, he may not be in their long-term plans despite being a first-round pick because he's been injured. So they want to have some, you know, some insurance there with a guy that they really like in Tyreek Gillespie, who's excellent, by the way. And if Abram is able to stay healthy, then you knock that one out the park. So they brought back Carl Joseph. Morig was the number one safety. They wanted someone that's more of a ball hawk. They want to turn the ball over a little bit more than they were. So that's why Morig makes sense. And he can also match up and cover. So it gives you a little bit of position flexibility in what he can do. And I think that's why they went with double safety. And when you look at Jeff Heath being a backup there and, you know, Levitt, another one that they really like that has played well. But they want to get more athletic. They want to get younger. They want to get better. And want to have depth in case Abram is out for an extended period of time because that's been his major issue. He's talented, but just hadn't been healthy 100%. I was more concerned with the Diablo selection and the Coon selection, more so than anything that they did in the draft. Those are the only two selections that I really questioned. But you're really talking about third-round picks in that regard. So how much do you expect them to really see significant time? And it goes into what I said about Dwayne Eskridge. You look at Diablo and Coons probably being special teamers or rotational guys initially, and if they grow into something consistent, then that's a good pick in the third round. But right now, strengthening your special teams with anything outside of the second round is where the focus probably is with a lot of these teams.
Emory Hunt joining us from CBS Sports and CBS Sports HQ and Football Game Plan as well. There's a popular phrase, Emory, that the great moves are usually greeted by yawns. And so I go through this, and as much as people talked about, hey, Trey Lance and Trevor Lawrence and this running back to this team, all this sort of stuff, you know, some of the teams that you'd expect had great drafts, it's the teams that are always competitive. I looked at Baltimore, and I was like, yeah, every draft pick made sense. It wasn't necessarily the sexy, high-flying player, but every pick made sense. Indianapolis, kind of the same way. I thought, you know, getting an edge rusher where they did made a lot of sense. To you, when you looked at the teams that are historically great, did any of them stand out to you of, you know, they may have misstepped over the course of the weekend, or did they all just make the right kind of moves?
This is the second year in a row where I thought every team did solid jobs in the draft. And I truly believe because of the situations that we are in, you know, we're still in a pandemic. Last year was, you know, the height of the pandemic, and we still didn't know a lot about anything. So teams really couldn't go anywhere. Everybody was relegated to just watching film. And I thought everybody last year had good drafts. Then you fast forward to this year, nothing really has changed from a travel standpoint. Teams still wasn't able to be as mobile as they were pre-pandemic. So teams still had to rely on the film. And it's interesting because I leave this draft saying, wow, there's not one team that you can look to and say, dang, these dudes blew it. Because I just think everybody now has to just focus on film and it's made their life a lot easier. Less is more. And you've seen teams just nail picks early and get good value late. And I just think maybe teams need to rethink this whole strategy that they've implemented during the pandemic. And, man, maybe we don't need the combine or focus on the combine like that outside of the medical and interviews. Maybe we don't need all these 50,000 pro days, you know, just and we could just focus on the film. Because at the end of the day, that never lies. You can game workouts, so you can get, you know, drop weight, get faster, gain weight, get stronger. But how you play is how you play. And I think teams have focused on the film. And that's why, like I said before, these last two drafts, everyone has done a really good job.
With so many offensive players being taken, you know, in the first seven picks are all offensive this year. Is that a sign of where the NFL is headed, or is it a function of the fact that this year there wasn't a great player on the defensive side of the ball that's going to jump up there and get picked before those seven players went?
I think it's the latter. You know, next year you're probably going to see more defensive edge rushers than you saw this year. This year the strength in defense was on – it was in the back, in the secondary, but with the cornerback position. That's why you saw a lot of corners go. But that, I think that's the major reason why we saw so many offensive players go. This was just a draft where, and this is going to be like this for a while, you're going to, quarterbacks are going to always get overvalued and pushed up the draft board. You're going to see a ton of receivers come down the pike because everybody's throwing the football all over the place in college football. And as the byproduct of that, you're going to see good cornerbacks go off the board. But I just think that this year it was unique because you had a really good offensive line class, some good guards in there, not that many pass rushers that were elite. There was no Kayvon Thibodeau in this class or Chase Young, you know, just to use someone that from a previous draft class. So I think that's why you saw the run on offensive players. And I think next year it will look a little bit like normalcy. We'll get back to a little bit more balance. You'll see some quarterbacks, some receivers, corners, linemen, D-linemen, some edge rushers. If anything, you may not see a linebacker go high in the draft like we did just previous with Michael Parsons.
I want to ask you about a team that I had some mixed thoughts on what they did over the weekend, and it was the New York Jets. So I thought, you know, I like Vera Tucker. I like Elijah Moore. I'm not a big Zach Wilson guy, but you know, when I look at the whole of their draft, I can say, okay, I can understand why you chose these players. But sometimes to me, the process in which they went about doing it felt like they may not have maximized their value. You know, trading up for Vera Tucker when it is a pretty deep offensive line draft to me didn't make a lot of sense. And it feels like it takes away from your opportunity to fill in some other holes that are very obvious on this roster. What did you make of their draft overall?
I thought they did an excellent job. If I had to give a grade, I would give them an A. You know, they got their quarterback. They did a good job in building around him, adding Vera Tucker to an offensive line that started to play better down the stretch. But now you got two young studs in Mekhi Becton and Vera Tucker. And you add another receiver in Elijah Moore, which probably spells the end for Jameson Crowder, who's similar in what Moore could bring to the table. Think about this, too. Going into the draft, they added Keelan Cole. They added Corey Davis. You get Denzel Mims in his second year, so the receiving core is stacked. Then they add Michael Carter in the fourth round. That's their starting tailback, and how excellent he was at North Carolina, they got him in the fourth round. And then on defense, you know, you add Jason Pinnock in the fifth round that I like, a cornerback. Michael Carter the second from Duke, long, lengthy, athletic corner. They needed depth at corner, and they were able to add that with two guys that can play. Pinnick is a good press corner. Carter has a good athleticism to follow guys all over the place. And Brandon Echols of Kentucky is one of the feisty slot corners, but he's more of a special teams guy like we talked about earlier. And Jamie Sherwood of Auburn, his tape was impressive, man. You watch him play, and you're just surprised at how, you know, consistent he was around the football. And Hamstead Nasruddin out of Florida State, they see more as an outside edge rusher. That's some place they needed to add some more depth. He provides that depth there. So I actually thought they knocked it out the park from top to bottom, considering what they did in free agency in conjunction with where they were selecting in the draft. Every pick had a purpose, and I just thought they did a fantastic job.
Okay, so, you know, quarterback picked in New York, you know, Jacksonville gets their guys. Out of the one selected, you know, and let's count Fields in that when Chicago makes the bold move to trade up to him. As we look back on this draft years from now, which quarterback in your mind is going to be the one that stands out above the rest?
Justin Fields, because he's in a really good situation. We don't give Matt Nagy enough credit for getting to the playoffs twice with Mitch Trubisky. So imagine what he's going to do with an actual talent like Justin Fields. And we will soon find out how talented that Bears offense is. They've always had talent. They was always, in my opinion, a quarterback away from being a dangerous team. They already have the defense. Now you add a quarterback that's a dual threat player with some good weapons around him already in place. The offensive line is going to be what to watch for because they just let go Charles Leno. They're banking on a rookie, Tevin Jenkins, starting at left tackle. So the offensive line may be a bit of a question, but Justin Fields and how he plays, you know, they said he's Dak Prescott. I look at him as a Deshaun Watson type because of the mentality that he has. And Dak has the same type of mentality. So those are two really good quarterbacks. You could say those are two top six or seven quarterbacks in the NFL right now that draws comparison to Justin Fields. So me, it's Justin Fields. And, you know, Trevor Lawrence is going to do fine. I think Zach Wilson is going to do fine. And to be completely honest, those are the only three quarterbacks that I was taking in the first round. Lance is a wild card because we hadn't seen a lot of Lance. And to go from the FCS, limited starts, into a situation where he's probably going to have to play early more than he should have, than he should play. I just think that those three guys landed in a really good situation, and Lance landed in a good situation. But if I'm going back to my evaluation, Fields, Lawrence, and Wilson were the only first-round picks, in my opinion.
For fantasy, actually, just really quickly, because I'm sure Allen Robinson owners have been frustrated watching him try to catch passes from Trubisky and Blake Bortles. For all the people that have retained Allen Robinson stock, is this finally the time their loyalty will get rewarded?
Exactly. This is why you trust what you see and stay the course, man. And Robinson is he's in prime spot for a breakout year. You know, the tight ends are going to be in play as well. They get back to Rick Cohen healthy, and he's going to be a factor. You know, Khalil Herbert is someone he got in the sixth round that should be a sneaky play for people that play Dynasty, I believe it's called, where you stash guys on deep rosters. Daz Newsome. I mean, think of all the speed they just added with Herbert, Newsome. They got Miller and Mooney. Like, this team is going to be explosive because of how the quarterback plays. Cole Kmet at tight end, Jimmy Graham, you know. So because you have a quarterback that's mobile and you can only play a certain amount of coverages, otherwise he's going to take off all day and burn you that way, it's going to be a field day, pun intended, for these receivers running against those coverages.
It's Emory Hunt, one of our favorites. You can follow him on Twitter at FBallGamePlan on Twitter, and also works for CBS, the CBS Sports HQ. Emory, thank you very much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Appreciate you guys.
That's Emory Hunt joining us here on Bick and the Boss. It's done. So I guess now we just wait for training camp season with the NFL.
Yeah, I feel a little bit better about my Raiders now. I'm just never too sure what Gruden and those guys are doing. You know, the Aaron Rodgers stuff broke, and you know, that was the timing of all that was great.
Devontae Adams sending out a cryptic tweet, I guess.
Yeah,
to some degree, at K15 Adams, gotta appreciate what you got while you got it. Is that in reference towards playing with Aaron Rodgers and just appreciating the here and now, or is that just him talking about something else?
Yeah, who knows? But just the way of the world, and you know, we've gone from athletes not saying anything to athletes saying, "I'm going to retire if I don't get traded, or if the GM doesn't get fired, I'm not coming back." Interesting stuff. And you know, to think of Aaron Rodgers and the power that he has, the career that he's had, and to kind of lay that down just at the start of the draft, it was fantastic theater. It was unbelievable.
It's I never thought in a million years a player would leverage Jeopardy versus his own team to try to get his demands.
And he wasn't that good at it. Like, honestly, I felt he lacked it. Look, in the Jeopardy host.
There was a lot of potential there. But he was very stiff, right? He played it like a football player. He was kind of stiff. He needed a bit more looseness. He, you know,
He needed more energy. He needed more Sat. You know, Sat, you know, he should follow Sat's lead on those TV commercials he's doing now. You know, he's the wonder guy with Murph. You know, that he needed more Sat. He should study some of that film.
I think you'll see Sat on the TV panel tonight. So maybe Aaron Rodgers can tune in and get some pointers on that. Sat's also coming up in a couple of minutes on The People Show with Dan Riccio and Randy Janda. Don Taylor going to join us at 4 o'clock and Ryan Kessler at 5 o'clock. He had to defend Connor McDavid, and he might put up 100 points. He also had to defend Sidney Crosby. So McDavid surpassing Crosby in some point totals after a certain amount of games. Who was tougher, Sid or McDavid? We'll talk to Ryan Kessler about that. Plus, get you set for the Oilers, Canucks at 7 o'clock on the Land Rover pregame show, all on the way here on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.